Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is writer, historian, and editor, Greg Mitchell. And we're talking about his new book, The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Greg, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
I didn't realize what I was getting into when I started this book, but this is a pretty crazy history. How did you come to the story? I know that you've written about the atomic bomb before, but how did you come to this movie and telling this story?
Yeah, it's, few people even know about the movie, let alone the story behind the movie. So, but I was at the Truman Library out in Missouri, researching one of those previous atomic bomb books. And I came across, surprisingly, in the Truman files, several or at least two or three large files pertaining to this movie. And, it had scripts and edits on scripts and correspondence between MGM people and the White House. And so it was, I'd heard about this movie before, so it was not a complete surprise, but I was shocked at the involvement. And so I wrote a little bit about it back then, and then I just kind of kept up with it and, kept assembling some research. And then when I got the contract for the book a couple years ago, I then did a sort of a massive amount of new research to make it a full, a full book. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of plots and subplots and directions it goes in. So it really tells a full story of that crucial turning point for America right after the war. And so it's pretty wide ranging, while also
It's got a cast of hundreds. I mean, there's everybody's, and it's, I don't know of any other film where they've gone after the people who are producing the film, in this case MGM, decided that they would need the approval and of the president, of the people who were the military who were working on it, and then of the people who worked on the Manhattan Project. And so all those people were involved in decision-making and okaying script points all along the way.
Yeah, well, they did have to get permissions to portray everyone from Albert Einstein to General Groves, Leslie Groves, who was head of the Manhattan Project. But the crucial difference was that while they had to kind of chase these people and get them to sign contracts, only Groves and the military were given basically script approval and were given money. Groves was given $10,000 as an advisor, which was the equivalent of $120,000 today, which is sort of unheard of unless you're optioning someone's book. And the scientists, Einstein, Robert Oppenheimer, and others, were they wanted to get them to be portrayed, but they were not given the same kind of input. So this movie, which started as the very much from the scientist's point of view and scientist warning to the world and raising questions about the dropping the bomb on Japan, was then changed almost 180 degrees in the other direction because the military and Truman himself were given script approval.
And that's one of the sub-themes of this book, is this, how this movie turned into a piece of propaganda.
It's sad in a way, because this was a brief period when things were really kind of up for grabs in terms of what the narrative of the making and the use of particularly the use of the bomb and whether to make new and bigger bombs. And we kind of take for granted today, not if we don't know the history, that there was kind of a straight line. We built and used the atomic bomb, and then we built and tested the hydrogen bomb, and we had this arms race with the Russians as if that could not have been discouraged. But there was a great movement at the time and sentiment that, while we couldn't, as they say, put the genie back in the bottle and pretend that a bomb could not be made, we could have had more international control, and possibly, we don't know if it could have happened, but possibly we could have not moved on to the hydrogen bomb and the arms race and other countries and possibly terrorists. All the nuclear dangers today could have been lessened, if not eliminated.
What was really disturbing to me was the sort of writing the narrative where Nagasaki, the bombing of Nagasaki, sort of goes into our collective amnesia.
And that
was very purposely done.
Well, the one of the most revealing things in the movie was that, as I found, because I did, I'm sort of surely the only person interested enough to ever go through all the scripts and correspondence and things at the Motion Picture Academy Library in Beverly Hills. I could see from as the months went on the changes that were made in the script, the additions and subtractions, and it's very revealing in the book. It kind of traces how many of them came in response to General Groves and others. But one of the most revealing things is that in the early on, there was the Nagasaki bombing was portrayed, and certainly was part of the movie very, very much so. And then it started to get truncated, and by the end, it was disappeared completely. You could watch this movie and never know there even was a second bomb. And it's particularly revealing because it wasn't just a matter of we have to save time or,
It's
a rather important event to leave out.
Well, there is growing sentiment at that time. There are people who go, okay, I can sort of understand why you dropped the bomb in Hiroshima. But then after 3 days, dropping the bomb in Nagasaki sort of seemed like we're just being,
we didn't care,
yeah.
And so that's why it's sort of revealing, because as you say, it was, some people even at the time had that view, and that's grown with many people since, historians and others who just feel like, some outright called Nagasaki a war crime.
Right.
So it's better to get it out of the public consciousness, and they pretty well succeeded. We saw again this year at the 75th anniversary, very little mention of Nagasaki, and the book makes, I guess, makes the case that this Hiroshima narrative has endured now for 75 years and didn't change much. I'm glad my book got a certain amount of attention, but by and large, the narrative has not changed. Once it got nailed down, which this movie had some role in, and other actions, as I detail in the book, in 1946, established that this defended this Hiroshima narrative of why the bomb had to be used, and it has held sway now for for 75 years.
Now, amazingly, the story opens with Donna Reed.
one of my favorites from.
I love Donna Reed, but I think we're about the same age. I might be older. What did she have to do with the story?
Well, it all starts literally on the first sentence or first paragraph, where she's establishing herself as a rising star in Hollywood, and she receives a letter from her high school chemistry teacher back in Iowa, who had disappeared a couple years earlier, much to her alarm, and turns out he had been working in the Manhattan Project at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And now he was one of the activist scientists who were all over the country raising, sort of like with climate change today, if you can imagine a science movement who were clamoring and getting a lot of attention, and raising warnings about the future. And so he writes a letter to her and says, we really would need Hollywood to make a big budget movie that will warn the world about not going down this nuclear path. And so her husband happened to be a Hollywood agent, and so he and a producer soon were sitting down with Louis B. Mayer, legendary head of MGM. Mayer loved the idea, said, this is going to be the most important movie I ever made. Launched this, and on this path to being, raising the questions from the scientists. And then, as I said, they ended up giving script approval to Groves and the White House and others, and it went in the other direction very, very quickly, and then accelerated over the months. So Donna Reed is not in the movie, unfortunately. It probably would have been better if she was, but she had the sense to stay out of the movie itself. certainly she was right in the thick of it there at the beginning.
Now let's talk about the time period we're talking about. I just realized we never mentioned that. This is really soon, for my money, pretty quickly after the dropping of the bombs.
Yeah, well, they got it took a couple months, which is probably even slow for Hollywood, I guess. And the book tells a story also. One of the major subplots is that at the same time that MGM was moving, Paramount was also moving on such a movie. And the difference was that Paramount hired Ayn Rand as their scriptwriter, and most people don't even know that Ayn Rand was a Hollywood screenwriter at all. But she had already written two or three scripts for Hal Wallace, who was a major producer, and so he hired her, and so I trace how, again, based on. Documents and letters. I went through all her scripts, all her outlines, all her correspondence. She actually sat down and interviewed Robert Oppenheimer twice.
She was very enamored of Oppenheimer.
Yeah. So it traces how she, the script she did, and they, we don't really have time to go into it, but they were quite wild and expressed her ultra. Capitalist, you might say.
As you write in your book, she saw the history of the bomb as a tribute to free enterprise.
Yeah, and that's it. It was supposed to be an individual scientist. They weren't working collectively. They weren't taking direction or help from Roosevelt or the military. It's the individual. So, in any case, when she finished about a third of the script. Hal Wallace was so alarmed, he immediately sold out to MGM and got rid of the project. Ayn Rand, however, made good use. She now had this free time, and she sat down and started writing a little book called Atlas Shrugged with the scientist character based on Oppenheimer. So she did come out of this with something quite major for her career.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is writer, historian, editor Greg Mitchell, and we're talking about his new book. I really strongly recommend it. It's not like any history you could have read this year. The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Nice tribute there to Dr. Strangelove.
Yes, well, it was one of my favorite movies growing up. It put me on this path, I suppose.
Let's paint a picture for the audience of Leslie R. Groves, General Leslie R. Groves. What was he like as a person?
Well, he was. He went to West Point. I think his father was in the Army. He was an engineer. He's actually the man who built the Pentagon. And just a very hard driving, by all accounts, quite obnoxious, egotistic. Later in his life, it's pretty clear he was probably anti-Semitic and racist also, but very, very hard driving individual, got things done. And so he was put in charge of the Manhattan Project, which he didn't want to do at the outset because he thought it would probably fail. It'd be a black mark for him. But he took charge and hired Oppenheimer, which was a risk because of Oppenheimer's friendships with Communist Party members in the past. So he directed the Manhattan Project to a successful conclusion in that they did invent and test this bomb. The book also shows how he was also central to the decision to use the bomb. He was central to the targeting, to getting these bombs used. You mentioned Nagasaki. He was very much involved in moving that bombing forward to get that done. And then after the use of the bomb, he was central in urging or testifying before Congress that the radiation was no big deal, and he had the quote that it was Japanese propaganda, and then he said he also he had heard that it was a rather pleasant way to die, the ones the Japanese who were dying.
Oh,
so,
my gosh. Oh my God!
But his role in this movie was you could say, why would Hollywood give script approval to someone that central in the story? You know, whatever you think about what he accomplished or what he did. You know, you generally wouldn't give script approval to someone that really at the center. I mean, more than Truman in many, many ways, he was the central figure in the making and use of the bomb, and in some ways covering it up afterwards. And yet he was given the script approval, and he saw every script, and he sent in dozens or hundreds of things he wanted changed. Some of them were trivial, such he didn't like the idea that he was being pictured as a big chocolate lover.
He was sensitive about his weight.
Yeah, he was very overweight. He wouldn't have gotten through basic training again, I'll tell you that. I mean, he was, in fact, today I don't think the Army would allow someone to be as bloated as he got. In any case, he had his finger in everything. And so,
well, he was really, he wanted to sort of mold the narrative, and he was very cognizant about how he was going to be portrayed, and this whole thing just, you know, it's, you bring this up in the book. There's a great last chapter in this book where you sort of bring up films about the bomb right up into today, and you talk about Paul Newman as a choice to portray Leslie Groves in that movie, and oh my God, we're still doing the same thing. We're still sort of painting this picture of Groves that's not really close to reality at all.
Yeah, well, he was. I mentioned that in 75 years there have only been three Hollywood movies about the making and use of the bomb. This some people call the most important event of the previous century, and there's only been three Hollywood movies about it. Plenty of documentaries, but. You know, as you say, that going back to Brian Donlevy, who was sort of a handsome, thinner version of Groves in the movie that we're talking about and for about my in my book, and then Robert Taylor, who was another kind of handsome star in the 1950s, and it was in the second movie about this, who played Paul Tibbetts, the pilot. Of the Enola Gay, and then the third movie, which you just mentioned, Fat Man and Little Boy in 1990, which was directed by Roland Joffe, who had directed The Killing Fields, for example. And Joffe, who I actually talked to at one point, had wanted to make more of a anti-nuclear or at least a balanced movie about this whole subject, but he made the fatal mistake of hiring Paul Newman to play Groves, and so that capsized that entire movie, as he, I think, admitted himself later.
Now, what was amazing, and it's detailed completely in your book, are the plot points that would come and go, the stuff that they would just fabricate to make it a better story or to have General Groves agree with it. Like, they had things like the Russians were suddenly going to go into Hiroshima with their plans on how to build a nuclear bomb just before we bombed it, that the Enola Gay was attacked by fighter planes, all the stuff they were just creating to make a better story. It's amazing the stuff that went on in the scripting.
Well, it was actually the Germans.
Russians,
But, I mean, it's one thing to, and perfectly normal for Hollywood to pump up a story or introduce falsehoods. It's not that unusual, even though in this movie they said it was based on based on true events. But what's revealing is that all these changes you mentioned and many others that were introduced all went in one direction, and the direction was to make the justify the bombing, to portray the missions in the classic brave, risky, way Americans, the heroes who risk their lives. As you say, with the Hiroshima bombing, which was textbook, clean as a whistle, no opposition, planes flew in bright sunlight and dropped the bomb, never threatened by the Japanese. Unfortunately, it almost feels like a sneak attack, you know, which we like the picture Pearl Harbor. But in this case, it was our plane getting in there, no opposition, you know. But in the movie, they had to make it dangerous, so they had the planes getting pelted with flak and shaking around in the sky, could have been shot down at any time, and so forth. So again, that's just an example of many where the changes were made. You might say in one level, classic Hollywood style, you know, why not pump up the drama? But it was always pumped up in that one direction.
What's also interesting is, while this movie is being made, John Hershey's Hiroshima New Yorker piece comes out, as well as, and you mentioned that had even more impact, was the Saturday review editor.
Norman Cousins.
Yeah. And those two pieces came out, and they had an effect on public opinion about this, the dropping of these bombs.
Yeah. Yeah, they were, that's why I say that this narrative was kind of held in the balance there in 1946 for a few months, you might say. What people don't know, I mean, people, again, this summer, people were celebrating or talking about the John Hersey piece, which, you know, some have called one of the greatest journalistic achievements ever. But they leave out the end of what happened. It did have this big impact, and then there was kind of a plot by Truman and Truman and his allies to get a counter story in another leading magazine, which was Harper's, and so they got a cover story in Harper's written by the former Secretary of War Stimson, in which was partly drafted by Groves and others. It was almost like the movie. Stimson was somewhat reluctant, but all these people joined in. McGeorge Bundy, other people drafting this article, and then it was published, and it had a tremendous effect. It was, it was about the decision to use the bomb, totally defending it, explaining it, and many in the media, including the New York Times and others, then kind of reversed the concerns they had, and sort of said, "This is now settled history." You know, they almost in those words. So let's turn the page. This argument is over. It's settled, and let's move on. Which unfortunately, America did, and so they did plunge straight ahead into this arms race, which was so costly for so many decades.
Who did they finally get to direct the film?
It's a guy named Norman Torog, who is an interesting career in that he had showed a lot of promise early on. He was for decades the youngest director to ever win the Academy Award in the early 1930s. Then he kind of went downhill a bit, was just doing very light movies, and he's hired to do this movie. And then actually his real claim to fame today is that he's the director who made the most Elvis Presley movies of anyone. I believe it's eight Elvis Presley movies.
Yes, but he also directed Dr. Goldfoot in the Bikini Machine.
Yeah. That was, I don't know if who was, maybe Annette Funicello was in that.
It was. And Vincent Price, I think.
Yeah, could be. But anyway, he was going downward into lighter fare, and so this was a heavier project, but, why they didn't hire... the book kind of pictures as a bit of a mystery why this went from the most important movie Louis B. Mayer would ever make into a movie with a not strong director at that time, not major stars.
The casting is weird. It's not an exciting cast at all.
Yeah, I don't know what... I speculate that it's partly because they spent so much money on the special effects. The MGM claim they didn't want to have a big stars. It would have capsized the reality. You know, this is a docudrama, one of the early genre of docudrama, and they thought for this serious subject, if you had a Clark Gable or Spencer Tracy or someone, it would take away from the subject matter. But you know, in a way, they shot themselves in the foot. You know, they took so long to get the movie made because of all these revisions. They had the movie kind of climax, or the book climaxes with the screening of the movie, first screening of the virtually finished movie in Washington. So they have this big screening in Washington, and they invite everyone from columnist Walter Lippmann to Truman's press secretary and scientists. And so this was in October of 46, and so Truman's press secretary and Lippmann himself were just alarmed by the movie. And next thing you know, the White House is demanding that the key scene in the movie where Truman explains his decision is reshot. MGM has to reshoot a costly scene, and they have to fire the actor. The White House wants the actor fired, and so they hire a new actor, and they reshoot the scene, basically dictated by the White House, almost word for word, and to fully explain Truman's decision, and that's why it is important to put this narrative down, get it down, show Truman, in command, making the decision based on good reasons, but again, the movie's delayed a few more months. So, in the end, MGM letting this happen to the movie really hurt them. And by the time the movie came out, people were less interested. Didn't do great box office. Very mixed critical reaction, and so it did not have a giant impact that they had hoped.
I just want to end with a quote from your book. When the scientists saw the movie, I think it's Leo Szilard, said, "If our sin as scientists was to make and use the atomic bomb, then our punishment was to watch the beginning of the end."
Well, that's that's kind of summarizes it from their point of view. And again, it's like Szilard was one of those activist scientists.
Yep.
He was had to be chased by MGM
right.
for permission to be portrayed. So he's just kind of a recurring character in the book.
This is an amazing history, both a film history and a military history. And my guest tonight has been writer, historian, editor Greg Mitchell. And we're talking about his new book. I cannot recommend it enough. The Beginning or the End, How Hollywood and America Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Greg, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You listen to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.